From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made with an AI prompt. Do you know how to write one effectively? Have you worked much with the ChatGPTs of the world or any of its cousins? Midsummer, things like that. When we first picked up a book about writing AI prompts, it seemed like a dry but important document that could help the lay public, like me. After all, AI is getting more sophisticated by the day, and most of us still haven't really dabbled much in writing prompts or understanding how to use it. As it turned out, the book is more than just its title, which is Writing AI Prompts for Dummies. The book offers ideas for how to AI-proof your career, how to find job security, even how to use AI responsibly. Because as we get better at using AI, we will have to think about what lines we want to cross and what lines we do not. The book aims to do all of that. How to generate musical content with AI. How to recognize when images have been messed with AI. And there's even an example of Taylor Swift endorsing a cookware brand, which she never did. How to level up your videos using AI. How to use AI to build a personal brand. And it might not be the future you're asking for, but it appears to be the future you are getting. And with that in mind, the book's important. And our guest is the co-author. Jeffrey Allen is the co-author of Writing AI Prompts for Dummies and director of the Institute for Responsible Technology and Artificial Intelligence at Nazareth University. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me again, Evan.
How long has the book been out now?
The book came out in the first week of May.
So your publisher, who should be listening, should know that by December, you're probably going to need to have an updated version.
I hope
every
they
6 months
listening.
Or so.
I'm ready to update when they're ready to update.
I mean, a lot is changing very, very quickly. The book is very much up to date. And we are going to get into, I think, a lot of very interesting questions on how we use AI, how to do it effectively, how to do it clumsily, and even how to do it sort of irresponsibly. So that's all here in the book. Listeners, if you've got questions, I am very curious to know if you have dabbled with any of these different applications, if you have found it difficult or easy to use, if you have found it surprising, if you want to know how to do different things. I mean, really, our guest in this book is what it's all about. So you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email us, connections@WXXI.org. At the risk of sounding like I'm doing PR for the book, it is organized in very easy to search and find chapters. I mean, no one's going to pick it up and read it cover to cover. You're going to look for what you need, and it's probably there. So how's that? Did I do a little PR? I'm not on the payroll.
No, absolutely not. And I think you did a great job there. And you know, that's a lot of credit to Wiley, the publisher, and the Dummy series. It's really designed so that you could pick it up at any given chapter and just start reading. There's no requirement to go in at chapter one and read it linearly like that. So I feel like the Dummy series, and you know, they've been around forever, it seems, is a really good series to start to get a grasp of certain topics, particularly technical topics.
I want to start by asking probably what is on some listeners' mind, which is like, why do I need this? So for listeners who have never dabbled with some of these really kind of the hot new applications and options that are out there, why do you think they should at least have some facility with writing AI prompts?
You know, from everything we hear and the things that I've been reading recently, it's coming to the point now where businesses are starting to integrate AI. We've been talking about this, I think, on this program for the last year. Every time I've been on, we seem a little bit closer to that. And now we're to the point, you know, where an article came across my feed the other day that basically said businesses are integrating faster than the public realizes. So the better we become with using AI, and the more we can use it to augment what we can do, be more productive, just be better at our jobs, the more successful we're going to be over the long term here.
I want to ask you to give listeners an example of an AI prompt that does not deliver results. Because right on the cover, create AI prompts that deliver results. How do we use it ineffectively? What's an example when you're kind of bad at it?
So one of the things that, you know, most people don't understand is prompting AI is iterative. And iterative essentially means that you're having this dialogue. It's not just a one sentence, hey, do this for me, and the AI does it. Because the AI, just like when you're talking to another human, they need some elaboration. They need some explanation. Some of the things that AI does get tripped up on is vagueness. And when you're talking about something and you tell it to do something, give me a summary of climate change and how it's impacting the agriculture industry. That's a pretty broad topic, right? we usually have to kind of narrow it down to something more specific. Specifically, what do you want to know about how it's affecting agriculture? For example, is it reducing output? Is it making areas of the world barren and unable to produce crops? So you have to get more specific, give it some more details. And usually from there, it's nice to add something of a question into the prompt as well. So I want to write an article about how climate change is reducing crop output. What are your suggestions about areas that I can really focus on this and cover areas that haven't been discussed much? So something like that is a much better prompt.
More specific, understand what you're looking for. And if you are good at writing these prompts, what are the different ways of sort of application in different professional spheres that you can see?
I mean, the most obvious ones are within marketing, public relations. These are the ones that really have taken a hold of AI, and they've ran with it essentially since it became public on the ChatGPT side. We're starting to see some other areas that are popping up now. HR is an interesting one that I've seen AI begin to show its usefulness in. They, on the HR side, that is, have begun to look at how it can be used to screen candidates and how it can be used to understand a candidate's real capabilities, who's worth talking to, when they make a job offer, how much should they offer so that they're not overpaying, but at the same time, they're not trying to make an offer so low that no one's going to accept it. These are the type of things that AI has become really useful within that space. And I'm starting to see it across a bunch of other areas. I was having a conversation with a doctor the other day, a medical doctor the other day, who was telling me about areas where it can be used, for example, within diagnostics, especially when there's an area that might sit in the periphery of your specialization or in an area that, you know, maybe there could be some after effect or some type of, I would say, crossover within the specializations that, you know, the medical field often deals with. So there is a ton of opportunity. I'm most excited actually about medical. I think I've said in the past many times that, you know, I think the uses in medicine are going to become some of the most important that we are able to take advantage of. But even in more what you might consider mundane areas, process-driven areas, content-driven areas, that's where we can see and immediately start to take advantage of AI right now.
So let me contrast medicine with marketing. Or even medicine with how students might use AI. I can't think of a whole lot of ways for AI to cheat in medicine or for AI to be an ethical problem, although I'm sure there are some that I'm not envisioning. But I'm mostly thinking of some of the recent conversations we've had on Connections or some that are coming up, which is how good AI is already getting at helping detect stage zero cancer, possible tumors, helping diagnostics. I mean, it's pretty remarkable now. I can't imagine where it could be going. The possibilities there seem very positive and very powerful and very real to me. Contrast that with what I think we have to do if you are a student in college in Jeffrey Allen's class, or if you're marketing, or if I'm writing for this show. And here's an example. I mean, the only really scripted part of the show is the first minute of the show, because I'm trying to tell a story about why I think listeners should care about the hour. So it's always scripted. It's typed out. I've never used AI to just write it for me. Let me start with this. Can I use AI to write that for me? And is that okay with you?
I think you could probably come up with a prompt that does what you want, that kind of scripts it out like that. The problem is going to be you're going to lose essentially your voice and your thoughts. One of the things I found about AI, as good as you are at prompting it, it never can quite get in your head, especially when you're on the creative side like this. You have an idea. You have a way, something you want to express, and prompting, you have to then figure out how to prompt it in such a way that it can get in your head like that. And that is a really advanced level of prompting that usually doesn't come out with just a single, you know, prompt or five prompts. It's something that you work through. And by then, you've written so much that you probably could have written it faster yourself.
Okay, that's fair enough. And I'm optimistic that will remain true. But how much better could AI get at approximating my voice?
And, you know, this is very interesting. Just before I came here, I was on a call with a company called Showrunner. Showrunner caught my eye in a Forbes article the other day. Showrunner allows you, through a prompt, to create an entire episode of animation. And one of the things I sat on the demo that I just watched was they put in Sylvester Stallone is giving you tips on boxing. And the voice was approximately Sylvester Stallone. And the one thing I found, though, was that it still felt a little flat, the delivery of it. It wasn't something that I probably would listen to or engage with just because it felt automated. It felt as if it was AI output. So I don't think we're quite there yet. I can't say what's going to happen in 1 to 3 years from now, but certainly I feel like at the moment we're not there yet.
Okay. So there's a difference, though, between your point that, you know, you could use an AI program to write the introductions for each episode of Connections. And it might do okay. It's probably not going to be exactly in your voice or in your style. Listeners might pick up on it. It has its downfalls. But if I decide to use it, do you think it's unethical to use it?
Now, that's a very good question. And certainly there's room for debate here because when it comes down to it, ultimately within business, our goal is to drive productivity, to do things efficiently and cost effectively as possible. If you subscribe to the shareholder value type model, the more value we can bring to our shareholders, the more we're upholding our fiduciary duty. So in that case, any tool that we can use, then that becomes something that can advance that goal. On the other hand, we have something when we think about artistic integrity, right? And that might be more, I think, what you're referring to along the lines of, you know, at a certain point, we think about popular music, right? There's a few bands out there, I won't name names, but we think of a certain band and we're like, okay, they write music to sell albums or to get listens, right? And then there's others who actually don't sell out, quote unquote.
So Nickelback.
I was trying to avoid naming, but yeah.
Okay.
but when it comes down to it, do you have that same sort of perception with an AI? It's like we're producing content to simply produce content and drive revenue from that versus we're doing something with artistic quality and integrity to it.
That's all fair. And so I think the nuanced response you just gave me, I don't think it's a dodge. I think you're saying it's a spectrum and you have to understand maybe what you're attempting to do. The reason that I would find it problematic for myself to use AI to write the introductions to these shows is because when Connections comes on, I want listeners to hear my voice and my words and for that to be mine. And if I'm quoting somebody else, I'm going to tell you I'm quoting. And if I didn't create it and I'm not quoting, then I feel like I'm appropriating. I don't feel like that's actually me. And I don't think AI can be me. So I don't feel good about that. So my decision right now is not to use it for that purpose. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. And what you're doing here, and forgive me if you're in the marketing world and I say what you're doing here has substance to it, while a lot of marketing is kind of read it once, throw away, it serves a purpose of commercializing something. And I feel like that distinction is important too. So the integrity of what you're doing as a part of the media really doesn't, at least in my opinion at this point, require the human part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think that's pejorative to marketing. I think that's just making a distinction. Whereas marketing has all kinds of applications and some of what you go into here. But the next sort of related question, whether it's marketing, a student in your class, et cetera, I feel like we are learning literally through your book, writing AI prompts for dummies, or just through conversation. We are learning how to use AI responsibly, but we are tempted because we know that it wouldn't be hard to use AI in the wrong way. Here's an example. A student can say, I've got to write a paper on XYZ. I'm going to ask AI for just a little bit of information or some general ideas to get better information, to hone something. But then a minute later you go, boy, if I just write a better prompt here, AI could write this paper for me. And could I get away with it? So I feel like part of what your book is aiming to do is help us understand how to do it responsibly. But that temptation is right in our face a lot with this, isn't it?
I agree, and it is. It's the easy way. It's the path of least resistance where we go in there and we say, you know what, I need a prompt about 16th century economics within Renaissance Europe or something like that, some obscure topic that I don't want to ever learn about or retain. It's very tempting to do so. So I think it's important, number one, for the educators to start to create, you know, the understanding with their students as to what it is. Why are you doing this? What's the big overarching reason that you're doing this? What are we trying to understand? And then secondly, for educators, they need to start to think about, is that the right way in the modern era to be able to teach them what we're trying to teach them? We start to have to ask the questions about, you know, are we teaching in a way that's effective? Are we measuring outcomes and internalization and of knowledge in an effective way? And I think that's something that a lot of educators, and sorry to my colleagues who are listening, who don't want to face that right now, the fact that we need to re-examine the way that we deliver and evaluate educational outcomes. So that's one part of it. And then the other part of it is, too, you know, if you're a student in my class, any students who are listening out there, they know the expectation is that you will use AI as part of your coursework because it's part of your grade. And the ultimate thing that I want to see is not the expectation that you're not using AI. I want to see what you're talking to the AI about. I want to see how critically you're questioning and how well you're internalizing that dialogue that's going on. So there are ways to think about this and evaluate this that are a little bit off the main, you know, the mainstream about how education is traditionally delivered and evaluated.
Talking to Jeffrey Allen, who is the co-author of the new book, Writing AI Prompts for Dummies. Jeffrey is also the director of the Institute for Responsible Technology and Artificial Intelligence at Nazareth University. So let's just talk about a little bit more about writing good prompts, and then we're gonna shift a little bit. I do want to hear from you about sections in your book about AI proofing your career, your future job prospects. That's important for all of us. It's especially important for your students who are, you know, thinking about many decades of a career and wondering, where does AI fit? How does it make it better? Versus when does it threaten my? So I mean, that's all in the book too. But just on enhancing creativity, I want to go over some of what you write here, and then I want you to tell listeners more about this. You write that crafting creative prompts helps you exercise your imagination. I think the cynics professor would say, no, you're asking AI to use its imagination. You're not using your imagination at all. You say otherwise. You say better prompts and honing better prompts are going to activate the AI's creativity, allowing new and better ideas to come out faster. But that doesn't mean that you're trying to supplant your own creativity, I don't think, is what you're saying here, right?
No, I don't think so. I think it is a new tool in the same way that if you think about, for example, how we went from design within the visual design world and the era of Photoshop, how that shifted to digital design. There's that idea that it's a tool. It's a way to elevate and a way to bring to life something that was previously either impossible or mind-numbingly slow to do. I have a daughter. My younger daughter is just finished her sophomore year as a design major, and I was having this conversation with her the other day, and I said, let's think about it like this. To be able to craft a good prompt, a prompt that achieves what you want, does that not take creativity? Does it not take that ability to take this abstract concept and put it into words to get that output from the AI that you want? And that really, in itself, we need to start to reevaluate what is creativity. I had this conversation too with my wife the other day, and I said, don't you think that the Renaissance painters, the oil painters, the fine arts people, when the camera came out, said, oh, it's just pushing a button. How's that art? Ultimately, aren't we there right now? Essentially, that's a fairly decent metaphor for where we are right now with AI and its ability to become a creative tool.
On the subject of prompt writing, you do say that you got to construct your first prompt, see what the AI returns, and then be willing to modify to get different answers, to try again. That's kind of part and parcel with your initial point that too often our AI prompts are too broad. How many times are you tweaking, seeking to get what you want?
I would say the best answer to that is to what depth and what level are we exploring a particular topic. So if we're doing something very simple, give me a recipe to bake XYZ, then I should be able to do it in one or two prompts ultimately, right? The thing that will make a difference is when I, as someone who's experienced with baking, look at the recipe and say, you know what, I don't think that's a good ingredient to use in this particular recipe. And then I can prompt it again to say, you know what, I don't think that's a good idea, and then see what it outputs. Now, if I'm going in there and I'm starting to explore research related to, you know, something within the field of medicine where there's a very specific expertise necessary, first of all, I probably have to have that expertise to begin with, so I know what to ask it, and I know when information is incorrect or there's a better way to do it. And that conversation might turn into something fairly substantial, fairly lengthy. I have had conversations on very technical topics that have, you know, been, if they were printed out, they would have probably been more than 20 pages long. And that's the type of conversation you have to have on these more advanced topics. So I would say it's a judgment call, kind of depending on the depth and complexity of the topic that you're approaching with it.
Let me also offer some appreciation for the fact that, you know, the book is written in a really accessible way. And you do occasionally bring up ways that AI could be used not responsibly. So I mentioned the Taylor Swift, you know, I think in the book you said hawking cookware or something like that.
Yes, there was some generative AI used, and I, you know, I actually forget the incident right now, the specifics of it. I do remember the case though, where they had her in an advertisement, essentially promoting some cookware, and of course this wasn't Taylor Swift, and I forget if it was her voice they duplicated. But essentially, I believe she hit back with, unsurprisingly, a lawsuit.
Yeah, lawsuits are going to be key here. But that made me think of the fact that, like, when we talk about AI and how to use it responsibly, it's not just how am I using it. It's am I going to recognize when other people use it irresponsibly? So part of that section there, that short section on the Taylor Swift one, you write about, I mean, I'll give you some space to talk about here. Being a smart consumer of images, of ideas, of words, to recognize when something feels off. Do you think we're going to be good at recognizing when AI has been used irresponsibly?
I think we are now. My worry is that a generation from now, in terms of software generation, which might be 6 months to a year, we may become less capable. The idea being that if we think about the first version of ChatGPT 3.5 that came out, we knew that it would write fairly superficial treatments of topics. It would do something, when I look at it, it always reminded me of the very first year freshman, you know, first semester, first term paper they had to do. And they would be like, so-and-so said this, so-and-so said that. And it would be very superficial treatment of the topic. But now it's advanced to the point where it is getting more difficult to tell within the text output. Now, when I look at images, if you spend any time on LinkedIn, for example, you almost inadvertently can go, that was generated by AI, when you see an image accompanying a post.
Why? How?
It just has this sort of plasticky feeling to it. It feels like it's too perfect. It does, it definitely, when you talk about DALL-E, which is OpenAI's iteration of it, that feels very like it has a style that it prefers, and you start to recognize that style fairly quickly. But if you talk about something like Midjourney, which in my opinion is a far more advanced image producing capability, that is very difficult to tell right in its current version when it's been produced by Midjourney. So those are the things that I'm worried that, you know, a year, two, 3 years from now, we're not going to be able to tell quite easily. But the industry is working towards solutions to that. So we're part of the Content Authentication Initiative over at Nazareth, which is founded by Adobe. And part of what we're doing with CAI is that we're embedding essentially ways to tell and watermark when something's been generated by AI, so there's less questioning and less ambiguity around it.
Let me talk to you a little bit about music. And this is a little bit of a sidetrack, but I'm very curious to know what you think here, because there's plenty in the book about generating musical content, and it's AI is getting better and better at that. So recently there was a new song that came out from a country singer, Randy Travis, and Randy Travis has not been able to put out his own music since about 2013, when he had a number of health issues that basically robbed him of his ability to sing. And so he and his family had sort of accepted that that was probably it. And then producers took a song that he didn't write, but they thought lyrically it kind of fit his style. And then they took dozens of voice samples from Randy Travis over 3 decades, and they entered it into AI software. And through some tweaking, it wasn't the first pass, but they created a Randy Travis song, quote unquote, a Randy Travis song. And CBS Sunday Morning profiled it as like this beautiful, heartwarming thing. And I was like, no, that is not a Randy Travis song. That's a song that sounds like Randy Travis using AI. But then I'm like, well, who am I to say? Because he and his wife were emotionally moved by it. And they were, and she was grateful. She's like, I never thought I'd hear a new Randy Travis song again. And that, for all intents and purposes, sounds exactly like him. So, but it's out there in the world as a Randy Travis song. And I, so my first question for you is that a Randy Travis song?
Was it inspired by and created by the directions that he gave it? Maybe. I think there's an argument that it could be. It reminds me of the George Carlin, the comedy special, I guess for lack of a better word, that was created by AI, and his descendants were quite upset by that. It depends, in my opinion, on how much input the...
I missed that. A new George Carlin special, even though George Carlin's been dead for years.
Yes, and so...
So that's not George Carlin.
Yeah, essentially, that's essentially what the family says, too.
Okay.
And I agree with that. So George Carlin didn't have any input in that, and it was inspired by his style and his tone. Randy Travis, on the other hand, if he did have a part in making that, well, there's an argument to be made that he is part of that creative force, right? So it could be, and that's where we start to get back into definitions. How do we define creativity? Do we need to revisit that and to start to re-examine it? Because, I mean, the box is open, right? And so now we sort of have to deal with the future, which includes AI.
I don't think it's a Randy Travis song. That's just where I'm at. You're not moving me.
I give him a writing credit.
A writing credit. Whereas George Carlin's been dead for years, that is not George Carlin comedy. That is just comedy in the style that may have AI approximated voice. Whew. Anyway, let me get a little bit of listener feedback, and then what we'll do is we're going to transition to talk about some other themes of the book. We're talking to Jeffrey Allen. The book is available now, Writing AI Prompts for Dummies. And of course, it's in that the Wiley brand of books for dummies. Many, many famous, popular books like this, so you know what to look for. And my guess is it can probably help you because it made me a smarter AI consumer and user, I guess. I'm not a very smart one. David says, I'm working as a software developer. Everyone I know is using AI to at least do things like write me a Python or shell script to find all the text files, parse this word from the file name, copy the file, rename it, find that line in it, replace it with something like XXX, incorporating this word, or write me looks like a number sign to me.
C-sharp.
Thank you. <Yep. laughs> A C-sharp or JavaScript stub code to do the following task. He says, we're all looking for the time when we can tell it to write a piece of software soup to nuts. Some of us believe that time will come soon. Others believe it will never happen. That's from David. What do you think?
I think that's a very great point. I'm actually teaching a class at Nazareth this summer, which is analytics for human resources with AI. And the idea here being that there is some HR people who have data and they want to make sense of that data, use it to predict outcomes like when someone's going to leave their job and so on. How can they do that without having technical skills? So we're using AI to take things and write pieces of Python code and run it on Google Colab and be able to output some pretty impressive results for people who maybe don't know statistics and definitely don't know Python. So I think that's really great, you know, and there's some of my friends on the coding side have made comments to the effect of, well, really, how different is that than going to Stack Overflow and finding someone's example of code, which you then copy paste into your own code? Ultimately, there's very little difference in how you're assembling that code like that. I do think that it does act as a sort of an agent that allows you to get past the gatekeepers within the technical world, which, honestly, for anyone who's worked in a corporate environment, you do feel to a certain extent that the IT side is gatekept. Now, sometimes that's for good reasons, security and others, but at other times you feel like it's somewhat arbitrary. So being able to empower individuals who haven't had those technical skills, I think that's a really great use of the code. I don't think we're there yet from writing A to Z, a piece of software. I've actually experimented quite a bit with it. One of the things I find is the longer your code gets, the more modularized it gets, the more difficult it is to pull it together into a working application. And so I think we've got a little bit of a ways to go, but I know there's a very big focus in Silicon Valley on that right now, being able to produce something which will A to Z, basically create a program.
What's the time horizon for that?
I've seen some impressive gains. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if a year from now we actually had something that's able to do that.
Bob in Rochester says the conventional wisdom is that generative AI works like auto search on steroids, simply using probability to predict what words, phrases, etc. are most likely appropriate, relevant, and accurate to respond with. However, after spending a good deal of time conversing with AI, this does not seem to be enough of an explanation for the kinds of more subtle, contextual, and even insightful at times forms of reasoning. Is AI really only predicting words, etc., or is some other process going on that does not get discussed as much?
I feel like at its core, when they talk about general transformers like ChatGPT, that's essentially what's happening. But then we have to think about, too, how much are we as individuals using that statistical type of probability in the way that we reason as well? Because we think about it, over the course of our lifetimes, we've been taught there's certain ways to respond to certain things through the things we've studied. We've been taught that there's correct answers and incorrect answers. So to a degree, we're sort of doing the same thing ultimately, right? Now, these GPT-type models are able to do it with far more efficiency with a far broader range of knowledge. So to us, I think it really does look like there's certain magic happening behind the scenes, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what Bob is saying is he's surprised at how insightful it is.
Right, and I feel like we're inclined to do that, particularly given that breadth of knowledge, which I can't imagine any other human we'd have a conversation with would have that level or degree of insightfulness, right? And the better these models get and the more seamless they seem with their output, the more it feels to us like human. And it feels like it's coming from something that's not just a statistical probability model.
A couple things from Patrick. First, he says, I can understand what's being said about, I'll use the word not effective prompts here. He says, there's also an obligation of the person who is prompting AI to analyze what has been produced and determine whether it fits within the constructs of appropriate prompts and actually performing those prompts to receive an adequate result or even an exceptional result, and then take the AI results and add a conclusion that wraps it all up like any good paper or thesis. So again, that to me is like blurring the line here. So, you know, if you're a student using AI and you get a lot of good stuff and you go, yeah, I'm going to use most of this, but then I'm going to wrap it up. Yeah, I think that's when I would, I don't know, you're the professor. Where's the line?
I certainly think that when we do use it, we need to acknowledge we used it. That's one thing. That's just integrity, right? But ultimately, when you transition from the university environment to the corporate workplace, there's going to be an expectation that you use it and you don't waste time. I'm doing air quotes for everyone who can't see, but ultimately, you're not wasting your employer's time by doing things that could be far better automated. And so I do feel there's some argument there to be made that, you know, using it to wrap things up like that, using it to polish language, that's another thing too, because how often have you sat down and said, you know, this is what I want to write, and then you go after version to polish it and get quite, you know, the perfect way to articulate that? How much time does that take when you could give the same first version and say, fix this for me? And is it still your content at that point? Because you gave it the original version, right? If it's just doing an editorial job for you, then there's a lot of things we need to think through and defining again, what is your output? What is creativity? And kind of like, again, acknowledging to a degree that, yes, I did use that tool or this tool. I think really there is, there's a lot of things we need to reexamine.
Well, and to your point about employers, there's parts of AI prompts for dummies that talk about productivity, using AI to increase your productivity. Correct me if I'm wrong, but part of what you just said is not that, well, you know, it's a good skill to have for XYZ. Some of it is your employer will expect you to be able to use it to become more productive. Yes?
I attended a talk last month to an individual who was talking about AI and the use of generative AI from the corporate perspective. He was the CEO of a company. And one of the things he did say was to all the educators in the audience, not teaching your students how to use generative AI is doing them a disservice, because when they come interview with me, if they don't know how to use it, they will not be getting a job. And that's about as blunt as you can be.
How common do you think that mindset will be?
I feel like it's going to become more and more common, particularly within certain areas. For example, right now in HR, I feel that the writing of job descriptions is almost gone away. because why would we sit down and do that when we can actually produce very, very quickly in seconds a job description, something that used to take quite a lot of time? And so that type of like expectation is there now, freeing up the HR professional to do, again, more important things, which are not writing job descriptions.
Patrick adds, by the way, he says, I would love to hear George Carlin doing stand-up from heaven regarding his AI incarnate comedy. He would probably rip it to shreds. Patrick, he would definitely rip it to shreds, and he's definitely not in heaven. Michael says, Evan, would you feel differently if Randy Travis... by the way, I love George Carlin, so I was just kidding. Would you feel differently if Randy Travis had written the lyrics and AI used his voice to record it? As I said in a recent program, I would. I think it's a scale. I think it's a sliding scale. I don't think it's like there's one bucket of songs that are yours and one bucket of that's appropriate and that's just AI. This is a sliding scale. If you, and it's also, I want to be careful and say that I don't want to speak for the disability rights movement, but I'm sure that that AI can help the disability rights movement, that people with disabilities, people who feel like they can't do what they would like to do because of either a disability, a medical condition, and now all of a sudden maybe you can. So Randy Travis has a disability now, but his family feels like AI gave him his voice back. I would feel better if that were his lyrics, of course. I still don't think it's a Randy Travis song. I think it is a Randy Travis written and inspired song. And I think we have to be careful because I don't want to normalize handing over art to AI. That's how I feel.
And that's a great observation too, because that again brings up that we need to start to come to terms at a society, as a society, we need to start to come to terms in acknowledging what is and what isn't. I mean, does Randy Travis get a writing credit or is it entirely Randy Travis? Right. There's somewhere in between, right? We need to kind of determine where that is and how we're going to define that going forward.
David, maybe the ultimate skeptic in the audience. David writes to us from Vancouver, Canada, saying, this all comes across as advising simple-minded people to do some simple-minded tweaking to get questionable results from a technology that may well cost them their freedom and their livelihoods in the not-too-distant future. Okay, Jeffrey, what do you think?
That certainly is taking one side of the spectrum. I agree that it may be taking livelihoods for those who do not keep up with the technology. We had the same conversation probably around 1995, 1996 as it related to the internet. And I do remember at the time, the efforts that both governments and businesses put into upskilling people to be able to get the skills necessary to do their jobs with these new tools. In that respect, I don't view AI very differently. I certainly would be very careful about painting with such broad strokes to call people simple-minded. That is definitely demeaning on many levels. Otherwise, I think we do need to keep in mind that, yeah, these are skills that you need to continually upgrade to become future-proof in your work.
All right. Before we conclude with a little bit of a look at the parts of tens, if you don't mind, I just want to talk to you a little bit about future-proofing that work that you talk about here. And again, part of what the professor is saying is if we talk about future-proofing, you're clearly an optimist that AI can be used to enhance jobs and not just take away, but where is the most vulnerability that you see?
I would say that anything that lends itself to a high degree of automation is something that we need to be wary of. And this includes everything that's going on in the back office, like billing systems and coding systems. And that sounds a lot like the medical field. And it's because that's one industry that particularly sees a lot of vulnerability towards automation. So anything that has that type of characteristic to it is something that we need to be careful about. And some other areas, I think, when it comes down to like content within marketing is a big one. And that's the one that we're seeing immediately that's kind of going away. And marketers are finding the need to shift into more strategic roles where they're, again, planning and evaluating outcomes. Those are big areas where they're shifting into right now. Certainly, we're seeing that within the academic world, that shift more from this tactical level marketing to a more strategic oriented marketing. Those are the ones that immediately come to mind. But and again, anything that has a high amount of repetition that can be automated.
Tasks that AI can't replace, though. I mean, that's literally a headline in your book. And it feels like that list gets shorter with what AI is able to do.
So there's two areas, broad areas, I think, that AI would have a difficult time replacing right now and in the foreseeable future, and that is anything that's a human-facing side. So in medicine, that's the doctors and the nurses and so on. Within other fields, it's anything where there's a human component to it where AI just doesn't have that capability. The second one is fields that actually work on developing the AI in some way or the other.
I'm going to go down a list that you, a kind of a list of guidelines for jobs that will be important in the future, regardless of what AI does. Jobs that require the ability to understand people's feelings, like counselors. Right?
I would say counselors are there right now, at least on the beyond anything very basic.
AI is going to try to do some counseling. It's going to try to do some therapy.
You know, with someone with a psychology background too, I'm a little skeptical about it, but I know that
I'm glad to hear that.
There are companies out there that are trying to automate therapy. And while I think that you may get to the first level and kind of narrow down what the issues may be, it's going to take an individual to really get involved at that point.
All right, creative jobs, and you say this category includes artists, designers, people who work in entertainment. AI won an art competition in Denver.
But what is art, I think, right? We need to kind of explore that a little bit deeper. But I do think that the people who are in those fields now will take a hold of this. And, you know, from the call I was on earlier, they were very excited about using it as a tool. And these were all creative types who were on that. I was like the only academic on there. But they were very, very excited about the ability to produce things very quickly and get their ideas in production a lot faster than they would have been before this.
Jobs in business and particularly in management, you think, are AI proof?
I think for the time being, management jobs are AI proof, although I am seeing some rumors that the middle management is they're beginning to explore ways how middle management can be eradicated with AI systems.
Oh boy. You mentioned healthcare jobs, doctors, nurses, and we talked about how AI can supplement the medical field, but you really think people are going to be doing that work for as long as you can imagine.
I think anything that requires bedside manner is going to be a people task for the time being. But I am very, very hopeful about how AI can augment those individuals to make better diagnoses and other types of tasks within the medical field, which will ultimately make life better for all of us.
In general, you think teachers are pretty safe?
I think teachers are safe in the frontline facing part of it where they're standing in the classroom. But as far as lesson planning, as far as coming up with tools and metrics and so on, AI, again, can make their lives a lot easier, which is funny because we hear a lot of complaints that, you know, the teachers get paid for being in the classroom, but their job goes far beyond the classroom. And AI can actually help rein that in somewhat.
All right. And you mentioned sort of developing AI, developing new products. Now I want to talk about the kind of the future jobs that will be maybe that you and I growing up didn't think about because AI wasn't as much of a thing. So experts at integrating AI into different parts of businesses. Tell me a little bit about that.
Ultimately, you're going to have individuals who fill a role similar to what we call a business analyst today, where they look at a problem that exists and understand how technology can address that problem. I do believe that there'll be a need within the next decade where individuals come in and start to address business problems, organizational process, and so on, and how we can fix those with AI. There will definitely be a role for that. And that's actually one of the programs at NAS we do, our BAII program. We are teaching students to do that exact job right now.
AI ethicists.
AI ethicists, actually, we have something called Technology and Society at Nazareth, too, and the whole goal there is people who help come up with AI policy, what makes sense, what helps safeguard society, things of that nature, as well as judging AI output on its own, because someone always has to be continually evaluating what AI is doing, and it's going to be those type of individuals as well.
All right, people who can manage how AI and humans work together, there'll be jobs for that?
I do think there, and again, it might fall into that latter category we talked about, which is the individual who sits between the business and the technology side and understands how we do the current process and how we can make the process better with AI, and then how individuals can best be augmented within the work they do through AI.
And finally, experts in data privacy. We want privacy anymore?
To plug one more Nazareth program, our ethical data science program actually produces data scientists who also have additional training within ethics and the ability to look at things like data privacy. And I do feel that will become more and more instrumental, particularly as we continue to produce more data.
All right. So the one part of the book that I still don't know that I can get my head around is your feeling that we can use AI to build a brand or even build a persona. And I'm going like, what? And I'm reading here, but take me through a little bit about it.
I think the easiest way to describe this, so there's a few ways in terms of using personas. If we think about how marketers do it, or maybe media planners do it, we think about these are our listeners. These are the people who are consuming our brand. Who are they? Answering that question and going through and creating personas like that, where we say, okay, 35 years old, lives in the suburbs, married, has two kids. That's a persona, right? And so we can go through and create those types of personas within AI to be able to do things like, for example, marketing planning or UX design or other things that require that type of persona be built out. On the other hand of it, we can create experts who are, for example, I've gone through and created personas that said you're a well-known venture capitalist who invests only in winning Silicon Valley unicorns that have substantial exits. This is your background. You went to Harvard Business School, blah, blah, blah. And now I have a persona to bounce ideas for investment off of. So being able to use it as an expert, essentially, you've created an expert persona.
I think I would feel like a fraud. No?
I feel we need to use every tool at our disposal, essentially, to become better at what we do. So if that's going to contribute to that success, then I will use it.
All right. So I'm going to rip through, if you don't mind, 10 mistakes to avoid when writing AI prompts. We've kind of gone over some of these, but for listeners who are just joining us, the new book that's out now, the co-author of the book is with us in studio this hour, Jeffrey Allen, and the book is Writing AI Prompts for Dummies. So 10 mistakes to avoid when writing AI prompts: not spending enough time crafting and testing prompts, assuming the AI understands context or subtext, asking overly broad or vague questions, not checking outputs for errors and biases, using offensive, unethical or dangerous prompts, expecting too much originality or creativity from the AI, copying generated content verbatim, providing too few examples and use cases, not customizing prompts for different use cases, and becoming overly reliant on AI tasks that are better suited for humans. I just want to key in on two of those. Using offensive, unethical, or dangerous prompts. How does most AI respond when you try to do that?
Most AI will have something of a confirmation bias that happens when you use, I would say, dangerous. Now, it may sound like we're you know, don't launch nuclear missiles type prompts, right? But it's more along the lines of you asking leading questions.
Okay.
And choose any stereotype you want, insert it into a prompt, and the AI will then say, well, it does that because of this. And essentially, we're leading it. So you have to be very careful to remove bias from your prompts to get the output that you want. And so that would be probably what I would think of most. And a lot of the list you read off there, it all comes back to being very vague and very ambiguous and not having a lot of contextual background for the AI ultimately.
Well, and when you talk about checking biases, that's right there in your list. You're not checking outputs for errors and biases. You write, a common mistake when using AI apps is taking the results at face value without double checking them. I think a lot of people will feel like, I don't know how to double check them.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, most often you have to be careful when you're asking it to do something for you and you're pressing it for a result and maybe the result doesn't exist. So we saw the case of the lawyer. I think he was in New York City or something like that, where he wanted some case law to support a brief he was doing. And he's like, I need this case law to support this. And the AI produced something because it is there to please, ultimately. And it turned out the cases were fake. Well, a very simple fix to that would have been to go to LexisNexis and say, oh, this case doesn't exist. But he didn't do that single step that would have caused a whole, you know, what happened, the fallout of that. But that's part of it. The other part of it is going through and, you know, one of the things I actually do, and talking about bias and prompting too, a lot of people don't think of this. You can take your prompt and ask the AI, is there any bias in this prompt? What is it? How can I fix it? And you can actually use the AI to troubleshoot itself before this becomes a problem.
And it will be right?
It very, very often will tell you, it will dissect your prompt and tell you, no, this is problematic. You should rephrase it like this.
Let me wrap with this. Who do you think needs this book the most?
I would say anyone who has heard a lot about AI, maybe has some trepidation about what AI is going to do to their future or to society's future, and really wants to start to get a handle on it. We think we've made something that's very digestible, very easy to read, even for a non-technical audience, and is something that hopefully gets your foot in the door. It's like All Dummies book. The idea is to get you some footing and some grounding to move forward with, and I think it's a really good area to start.
Are you worried that there will be generational divides? I mean, I think my mother has an iPhone now. Her voice texts are epically hilarious, but she tries. She resisted it for a long time. She said, I don't want this. I didn't grow up with it. I don't need it. This, as tech gets more sophisticated, as AI gets more sophisticated, will there be generational divides?
I have no doubt that we will not only have generational divides, we'll have socioeconomic divides. And that those are two things that concern me to a great degree. And it's certainly a lot of focus on what we do at Nazareth and how can we try to eradicate those divides or preempt them before they even happen. But we realize they're going to exist. Now we just have to figure out ways to deal with that and become effective at making sure that we can kind of bridge those divides.
I mean, do you think a book like this can at least help in that way?
I certainly think this is accessible across generations, the way it's been written and the audience that it targets. I feel like no matter what generation you're in, you could gain some value from this. And considering it's offered in print and an ebook, it also kind of crosses the digital divide as well.
Where do you want people to find it?
Barnes & Noble is carrying it. It's on Amazon, where it's currently one of their best sellers in AI, so I'm happy with that. It's available at most every other major bookseller.
It's Writing AI Prompts for Dummies by Jeffrey Allen, the director of the Institute for Responsible Technology and Artificial Intelligence at Nazareth University. This is a book that's going to need a lot of updating, publisher, a lot changing. But as you do that, please come back. I mean, we're going to stay in touch with you. We appreciate what you're doing at Nazareth. And thanks for coming back and talking AI with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Writing AI Prompts for Dummies. From all of us at Connections, thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.